At the start of 1994, the population of Rwanda was thought to be about 7 million. 85% of those people were Hutu, 14% Tutsi. 100 days of horrific violence from April 1994 left at least 800,000 people dead, the vast majority of them Tutsis. Those 100 days ended when the forces of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, the RPF, led by Paul Kagame, overthrew the Hutu-dominated government. When the Tutsi-dominated RPF took over, over 2 million people, mostly Hutus, left Rwanda, causing humanitarian crises in neighbouring countries. The RPF has ruled ever since, and Paul Kagame has been the president of Rwanda since the year 2000. His domineering rule is the subject of a searing new book by British journalist Michaela Wrong called Do Not Disturb. The Guardian describes Do Not Disturb as part murder mystery and part sweeping history of an extended family tragedy spread over two countries, three wars, four decades, and a genocide. Michaela Wrong, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Thank you for having me.
Michaela, you start the book by talking about the day where you say you realised that you no longer believed most of the key truths that the RPF had built into its narrative of the Rwandan story. What are those key truths and why don't you believe them now?
Yes, I mean, like many of the journalists who went into Rwanda in 1994 to report on the genocide in a small country that most of us had never been to before, I was presented with this sort of picture in which there had been, as you say, this horrific violence. There were mass graves all over the country, fleeing refugees, and incoming this band of disciplined, highly motivated, extremely straight-talking, articulate, impressive rebels, the RPF, who were talking about ethnic reconciliation, who had, as far as we were concerned, had ended the killing and who were bent on reconstructing the country. And, you know, I think they sort of immediately had the sympathies of most of the media, most of the diplomatic corps, and many of the Western countries who've ended up being their main donors, because what had taken place before then had been so incredibly horrific.
Yes. And
they were saying all the right things. I think now, looking back on it, a lot of the context, the build-up to that genocide was unknown to most of us, whether media or diplomats. The way in which the invasion of the 1990 by the RPF of Rwanda had helped create this very toxic ethnic climate. And also the fact that, you know, the role of the RPF in bringing down the presidential claim of Juvenal Habyarimana was always denied by the movement. But ever since then, you've had more and more people coming out of the RPF ranks saying, no, we were responsible for what was the trigger act that set that violence in motion. Because as soon as that plane came down, that was when the killing began. So I think those are some of the doubts that set in. But also, you know, what became very clear was that the RPF had a lot of blood on their hands, both before they had seized power in 1994, but also afterwards when they chased those Hutus who had fled the country into Zaire, into Burundi, into Tanzania. They chased them into the forests and ended up slaughtering, yes, a lot of the people who'd committed the genocide, but also an awful lot of civilians alongside them. And I think, you know, it's been impossible over the years to watch what the RPF has done. It's repeated interventions into neighboring countries. And also it's increasingly repressive climate which has sort of settled on Rwanda, and not realize that this is not a band of angels. You know, that this is a very ruthless, very disciplined regime that has allowed, you know, has encouraged a certain narrative, has enforced that narrative, and is will now sort of slap down, squash, and try and silence anyone who questions it, but who has which has a lot of questions to answer.
Yes, indeed. The part murder mystery aspect of Do Not Disturb that you focus on revolves around Patrick Karegeya, who was Rwanda's former intelligence chief. Can you give us a brief overview of his life and career and also the circumstances of his death?
Yes, that's the sort of event around which I build my narrative. Patrick Karegeya was the man who would come out and meet journalists like myself when we went to interview Kagame In the post-genocide years, he was very charming, very ebullient, a sort of a good time guy who just liked hanging around with the media. And he was also part of that that machinery that in the RPF that built up this narrative in which the RPF were really presented as heroes who had ended the bloodletting and who were rebuilding the country. And what was so fascinating to me was I sort of from a distance followed his itinerary and the way in which he lost faith in his own system and fell out with his own boss. And that's a very significant change because he had actually been to the same school as Paul Kagame in Uganda. They had known each other since they were boys. They had joined the Ugandan rebel movement, the NRM of Yoweri Museveni when they were young men. They'd fought alongside each other. He had been the guy who had helped make sure that the RPF, when it went into Rwanda, kept being supplied with weapons and uniforms and ammunition because a lot of that stuff was basically being smuggled in from Uganda, and then became the intelligence chief and a very, very close advisor, the most trusted advisor of Paul Kagame. So when he falls out, flees for his life, ends up setting up an opposition movement, denounces the very system that he had played such a key part in establishing, and becomes an enemy of the state. And my book kicks off with his murder because he was lured to a hotel room in the Michelangelo Hotel in Johannesburg by a Rwandan businessman friend and ended up being strangled there by a group of commandos that had been sent from Kigali, clearly by his former friend and boss. Mm. To take him out. And you sort of think, oh, right, so this is, firstly, you know, what an extraordinary trajectory for that man in particular.
Indeed,
but also,
yes.
What does this tell you about the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which used to be this very united, idealistic movement? All, you know, they all had the same ambitions. They all knew where they were going. And also, what does it tell you about the ruthlessness of Paul Kagame and his willingness to sacrifice anyone and anything in his determination to maintain power?
Absolutely. And another thing that I think is prominent in this story is the fact that Paul Kagame himself had a background in intelligence. And I know in the context of Russia, everyone sort of focuses on the fact that that was Vladimir Putin's training as well. How much do you think that the sort of intelligence and dark arts training of Paul Kagame has sort of come to characterize the whole RPF regime?
If you talk to analysts, they will say this isn't just a military regime. This is a regime set up and run by military intelligence, which is what Kagame knew how to do. As a young man, he trained as an intelligence officer in Tanzania and then ended up being an intelligence officer for the Ugandan rebels. And I think, Rwanda today is one of the most closely monitored societies in Africa. I find it a very oppressive place to visit. People are very aware that they're being constantly watched, that their neighbors are reporting on them. There's a system of sort of 10 household cells, which are sort of monitored by officials and reported back to headquarters. People are very aware that their phone calls are possibly being monitored. The press is not free at all. I mean, the media is just completely sycophantic to Paul Kagame. There's no real feisty opposition that stands up to the ruling RPF. Civil society has been neutered. And whenever anyone actually sort of stands up and challenges the system, recently there were some very, a lot of complaints about the COVID regulations that Kagame had brought in. They will either sort of be taken in for questioning or they'll simply disappear, never to be seen again. Mm. Or what ends up happening is after a pattern of harassment, they'll flee abroad. And then they are on a hit list and will find that they are being, you know, watched, monitored, that the local Rwandan High Commission is keeping very, very close tabs on them. And in the case of the most high profile of these dissidents, like Patrick Karegaya, like his colleague General Kayumba Nyamwasa, there have been repeated attempts made to take these people out, to assassinate them. It's a regime that sort of doesn't recognize any frontiers and doesn't see any reason why it shouldn't just reach across around the world if necessary and take out its enemies.
Absolutely. The reach of the RPF's recriminations is truly, truly shocking. Michaela, in that context, it's also shocking and surprising to encounter the level of praise that you come across from Western governments and Western leaders for what's been achieved in Rwanda. Now, they tend to focus on the ending of the genocide, but also the achievements of economic development. Do you think those economic achievements and that track record actually stacks up?
What I found when I was researching my book was that while Rwanda's been an impressive performer, it looks like it hasn't been anything like the miraculous performer that it likes to present to the world. There are some sort of major question marks about some of its statistics, and that would strike me as completely in keeping with a dictatorship. You would have to be a very, very brave official indeed to go to President Kagame and say, I'm afraid growth is down this year. People live in absolute fear of this man. And I think that applies to people collecting statistics, to anyone involved in the development sector. And I think there is an extraordinary level of either naivety or cynicism in the development community that's working in Rwanda, because what they do is they look across the border at chaotic, disorganized Democratic Republic of Congo, and they say to themselves, well, at least here we can roll out our projects, you know, at least here vaccinations get done. We've got incredible improvements on maternal health. We've got primary school attendance is really high. So let's not rock the boat. Yeah, the human rights side of things is really concerning and deeply troubling. But by God, this country, this government really performs well on the development, you know, indices that matter to us. And I find that quite a cynical approach, because it takes it for granted that the only things that matter to Rwandan citizens are those kind of development indicators. Well, you know, I imagine most Rwandan citizens would like to think that the elections aren't being rigged, which they almost certainly are being on a regular basis.
Well, when President Kagame wins the last election with an approval rating of 98.8%, that does rather suggest that there's nothing free or fair about the elections.
Exactly. There's no country in the world that sees those kind of performances and where people think, oh, yeah, that was a fair election. So, you know, it's the sort of the real problem for aid officials working in Rwanda is that they're constantly downplaying those issues and always putting the emphasis on the sort of nuts and bolts, you know, whether there's bread on the table and teachers in the primary schools. But there are other elements to ordinary human lives that really matter to people.
How much aid is does the Rwandan government receive, and who provides it?
Well, the UK and the US have always been really big supporters of the post-genocide government. And I was looking at some World Bank figures recently, and I was a bit surprised to see that, you know, the government's operating budget fairly recently was 60% provided by foreign aid. And that actually means that governments like the US, like the UK, have huge potential leverage, and they could be saying to Paul Kagame and his very impressive ministers, I'm sorry, but we need to see some improvement on the human rights front and the accountability front and the issues like freedom of speech. And it seems to me that they just don't use that leverage because they're so sort of cowed by the persona, this very macho, you know, hardline persona of Kagame. And also there's a sense of mea culpa, of guilt for the fact that the world stood by and allowed the genocide to take place in 1994. And therefore this sort of feeling of, well, we can't criticize now because we weren't there, you know, when the balloon went up. And I think it's time to sort of stop falling into that trap, because that very much is a card that the Rwandans knowingly play to silence all criticism abroad.
Michaela Rong, you described the Kagame regime as very public image conscious. For better or worse, one of the most significant sort of cultural inputs into the image of Rwanda is the Hollywood film Hotel Rwanda. And that story itself has taken another dramatic turn with the current trial of Paul Rusesabagina, who was kidnapped and taken back to Rwanda, is that right?
Yeah, he was kidnapped, renditioned in August last year, lured onto a flight in Dubai. He was lured onto that flight by a bishop who said, come and address my congregation in Burundi. And then instead of landing in Burundi, the flight landed in Kigali. So he's been on trial now since February. And it's a very interesting case because I think that the Rwandan government assumed that this was going to reflect very well on them. You know, here the trial has been it's being shown on social media. You can watch it on YouTube. There's simultaneous translation in English. And I think they thought, you know, this would be Rwandan justice on display. But in fact, Rwandan justice, when it's examined in detail, doesn't bear up very well. So much so that Rusesabagina has withdrawn from the trial, saying that he doesn't think he can get a fair hearing. And that, you know, his lawyers are sort of constantly bringing to light the various discrepancies that mean that the trial by no means lives up to Western expectations of what a free and fair trial is. So I think it has slightly rebounded on Kagame, who I think thought he would get brownie points for the conduct of this trial. And in fact, I think it's really instead attracting a lot of criticism to this government that perhaps he didn't really need right at this moment. We just saw recently that CHOGM, the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, which was due to take place in June in Kigali, has been postponed for the second year running. And the reason being cited is COVID. That will mean that a lot of countries, you know, especially Asian countries, won't be wanting to fly or turn up in Rwanda. But there is, I think, a sort of bigger sense out there that Rwanda isn't sort of looking too good as a venue right now. And so that COVID has provided a rather convenient excuse.
Yes. Well, despite what you said about the possibility of going back to Rwanda, Michaela Ronga, I do rather assume that that is not something that would be on the agenda, even if COVID did permit it at the moment, given the nature of the recriminations that the RPF has a track record for. It's a compelling account. Thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thank you very much.
And Michaela is the author of the new book, Do Not Disturb, The Story of a Political Murder and an African Regime Gone Bad.